She tried to keep her voice level because the twins were right there at the breakfast table eating Cheerios, wiggling with excitement about going to see Wunderkids 3 off-island with Auntie Dee and Drew and Barney. In a real theater with Dolby surround sound and real popcorn with real butter.
It's not real butter, Casey said.
And big boxes of Milk Duds and Junior Mints and huge cups of Sprite. Auntie Dee lets us get whatever we want, Chloe said.
Andrea pulled Casey into the hallway.
What were you thinking? Delilah said it was a tradition.
How can anything be a tradition after only doing it twice before? Casey huffed. She was lovely. Her brown hair was glossy. Her face was golden with the sun. The acne across her forehead had cleared up. After 30 months of braces, her teeth were straight and pretty. She brushed with whitening toothpaste 4 times a day. She had been so, so helpful with the twins. She had essentially been their nanny all summer, and she hadn't asked for a penny. She looked at her mother and said, "If you don't want them to go, please call Delilah yourself, and then tell the twins yourself."
"You should have asked me," Andrea said.
"You leave me in charge to do everything except make decisions? Even you, Mom, can see that's unfair." "It sounded fine to me. They're leaving after camp and they'll be home on the last plane. I'll be here to wait for them because you and Dad are going out."
"No, we're not," Andrea said.
"Yes, we are," said Ed, emerging from the bedroom in his uniform. "The party starts at 7, and if you don't have anything to wear, I suggest you go out today and get something new." He was using his police chief voice. He was not suggesting anything at all. He was demanding it. Andrea glared at her husband, then at her daughter. They walked away, Ed out the door to work, Casey into the kitchen to gather the kids for camp. Andrea retreated to her bedroom. She started to shake. She could not handle this. Everyone else was ready to pick up and move on, go to the movies, go to cocktail parties, but Andrea was not ready. She did not want to move forward a single step without Tess. She picked up the first thing that caught her eye, the swimming trophy that she won in the city championships her senior year in high school. She had broken the record for the 200-meter butterfly. She threw the trophy against the wall, leaving a hole in the plaster the size of someone's head. Andrea collapsed on the bed. She had been doing so well. Delilah. It was just a movie, she told herself. It had not even been her idea. Drew had seen the trailer for Wunderkids 3 on TV and come charging into Delilah's bedroom while Delilah sat on her bed, staring out the window at the summer rain, staving off the demons in her mind, and said,
"Mom, Mom, Wunderkids 3, we're going, right? You'll take us all on Friday?"
"Wunderkids?" she said. News of this monumental event had slipped past her. She was full of holes. She asked Drew, mother to oldest son, if he would understand if they didn't go to the premiere this summer. Would it be okay if they went in a few weeks when she was feeling up to it?
"But Mom," he said, "it's a tradition."
And then Barney skated in, wearing only boxers and socks, and contributed his 2 cents.
"Yeah, Mom, tradition. We have to go."
Delilah eyed her 2 sweaty sons. Drew had defined biceps, and Barney had lost the baby fat on his cheeks. They were growing, but they were still kids. They were Wunder kids. They did not need to be dragged down into the pathologies of adulthood. They needed to be lifted up. It was true. Flying to the mainland to see Wunderkids in a proper theater was a tradition. Delilah decided, on the spot, that they would go. On Friday. Friday night was Phoebe's event. Phoebe would never forgive Delilah if she missed it. And so Delilah would fly back with the kids at 9, drop them with a sitter, change her clothes, and then hightail it to the event. She would tell Phoebe that that was her plan, or she would have Jeffrey tell Phoebe so that Delilah wouldn't have to deal with the inevitable complaints. Delilah set it all up. She bought the movie tickets online. She rented a car. She booked the plane. She called Casey. Chloe and Finn had to come. It was part of the tradition. And she asked Casey to babysit after they got home so Delilah could head out to Phoebe's event. Casey agreed. They were all set. It was just a movie. But Delilah's wheels started spinning. She did laundry. She called the cleaning ladies to come, and the carpet cleaner, and the landscapers to mow the lawn. On Thursday, she grilled a rack of ribs and made her famous squash dish and her blue cheese coleslaw, and the four of them ate as a family for the first time in weeks in a clean house on a tended yard with a little Crosby, Stills, and Nash for background music. Delilah cleaned up and saved the leftovers in Tupperware while Jeffrey read to the boys. Delilah had fallen into the habit of allowing the boys to watch the Red Sox until they fell asleep on the sofa. But Thursday night, she said, "Up to read, boys. You're in serious need of some dad time." When Jeffrey came back downstairs, Delilah was in their bedroom with the candles lit. She had put on a camisole. They made love, and afterward, Delilah went to the kitchen and brought back a piece of blackberry pie smothered with whipped cream. When the plate was devoured to a few purple smudges, Delilah fell back into her pillows and said, "I love you, Jeffrey Drake." Jeffrey said, "Tonight was really nice." She agreed. It had been really nice. But it wasn't quite real. "Don't forget, we're going to the movies tomorrow," she said. "You have to go to Phoebe's event by yourself, and then I'll meet you there, okay?" "I'll just wait for you," he said. "We'll go together."
"No,"
Delilah said. Her eyes flew open. "Why are you shouting?"
"You have to go to Phoebe's event at 7. You have to go no matter what. Promise me."
Silence. She punched his arm.
"Promise me."
"Okay, I promise." Her wheels were spinning. Friday morning, she went to the store before anyone else was awake. While the kids were at camp, Delilah made chicken salad and a pan of her roasted Asiago potatoes. She made cucumber coconut soup and a bowl of corn and chive salad with pine nuts. Then she cleaned out the refrigerator. There were Ziplocs of old pizza and half-empty containers of eggplant parmesan from the farm market. In the very back, she found a leaking container of strawberries covered with fuzzy green mold. The very same strawberries the kids had picked at the farm on the day Tess and Greg died. Once the refrigerator sparkled, Delilah moved into her bedroom. She made her and Jeffrey's bed with clean sheets. She plumped the pillows. Then she cleaned off the top of her dresser. It was safe to say the top of her dresser had not been cleaned since Barney was born. Delilah liked messy surfaces. She liked leaving bits and pieces of her frantic life all over the place. The New Yorker opened to an Alice Munro story, an ad for Sergio Rossi's shoes ripped out of Vogue, a recipe for gazpacho, a picture that Drew had painted, a pair of dangly earrings, a Marshall Tucker CD, her hot pink thong, her birth control pills, a photograph of the boys dressed as pirates on the Endeavor, a gift certificate to the Languedoc, her gold pass to the chicken box. Delilah was proud to display these reminders of her personality. She was glad to be too busy to put everything back where it belonged. But now she swept up all the bits and pieces and hid them away. Then she dusted the top of her dresser and waxed it with Pledge. All that sat on the dresser's surface was a fresh white doily and her wooden jewelry box, closed. She sat on the edge of her perfectly made bed. This room no longer looked like her bedroom. She pulled an overnight bag from the closet and packed a few things for her and a few things for each of the boys, just in case. Pajamas, toothbrush, change of clothes. It was just a movie, but what you learned when you lived on an island was you never knew. Her wheels were spinning. She left a note for Jeffrey. At least it was sort of a note, and went to get the kids from camp. They took the 2:30 Island Air flight. Drew and Barney had flown on the 8-seater Cessnas dozens of times, but it was more fun with friends. The kids were slap happy. Delilah probably should have told them to settle down for the sake of the other passengers, but she hadn't seen them this happy in a long time. It heartened her, and she would not squelch it. She picked up the rental car, a Plymouth Voyager, a minivan. Delilah groaned inwardly, but the kids each claimed a captain's chair. They were happy. They were in Hyannis, and it was liberating. 30 miles of water separated Delilah and the kids from everyone else, and though it technically took only 15 minutes to traverse the gap, it represented psychological freedom. Delilah cranked the AC and slipped in the kids' favorite disc of High School Musical, Buck Cherry, Smash Mouth, and good old Bob Seger. The kids had skipped lunch. They clamored. And so Delilah pulled into the drive-thru at McDonald's, and it was Happy Meals all around, and a huge Diet Coke for Delilah. The Cineplex of their summertime Wunderkids tradition was in Pembroke, south of Boston. It was the very same Cineplex that Tess's brother used to manage before he moved to Attleboro to be closer to his kids. It was perfect. Delilah bought popcorn with extra butter, bucket-sized 7-Ups, nachos with melted cheese and shriveled jalapenos, a soft pretzel with mustard, a package of red Twizzlers, a package of Raisinets. This, she decided, would be dinner. They munched and slurped. The kids were engrossed in the movie, their faces shiny with butter. They laughed, they cheered. Wunder Kids! Delilah did not watch the movie. She watched the kids watching the movie. Delilah's wheels were spinning, but the kids were carefree. Delilah checked her watch. It was 6:10, 6:20, 6:49. Phoebe's benefit started in 10 minutes, and Delilah would not be there. Delilah was in an alternate universe, where she was set free from her usual circumstances. It felt good to be away. It felt great. She did not think about Tess, Greg, Andrea, the Chief, Jeffrey, April Peck, the Begonia, Tom and Faith, or her own horrible lack of discretion and judgment, her tragic mistake caused by love and attraction that were forbidden and profane, because she was living in the moment. She was at the movie with her children. She wanted to stay in the dark theater with her kids cheering forever. When the credits rolled, Delilah filled with dread. She checked her watch. They had plenty of time to make it back to Hyannis for the last flight. Delilah made the kids use the bathroom and wash their hands and faces with soap. Then they piled into the car, humming the Wunder Kids theme song. "Well," Delilah said in her best gung-ho camp counselor voice, "what did you think?" Yes, they had loved it. Yes, she was the best mom/auntie in the whole wide world. "I can't believe it's over," Chloe lamented. Delilah agreed. It had gone too fast. She had only begun to breathe like a normal person. The thought of going back to Nantucket and of having to attend a cocktail party weighed her down. She would skip the party, she decided, and incur Phoebe's wrath. It was nearly dark outside. After Delilah had been on the highway for 10 minutes, the chatter in the back quieted. Delilah did not want to go home yet. She racked her brain. How could they prolong this trip? What could they do? Delilah spied a billboard for a Friendly's ice cream parlor at the next exit. Could she in good conscience buy the kids ice cream after plying them with so much grease and sugar at the theater? "Hey," she said, "does anyone want to stop for hot fudge sundaes?" There was no answer. Delilah checked her mirror, then turned around to double check. All 4 kids were asleep. "Hey," she said. No one moved. She did not think, and the not thinking felt good. She turned herself around on the highway and headed west. Phoebe. She arrived back on the Savannah at 5:00. She had been there all day with her clipboard and her checklist and her skill at tying knots in the slick silver ribbon attached to the iridescent pearl-colored balloons. Was everything in order? Everything was in order. Flooring had been laid over the scrub grass, and a tent was erected over the flooring.
Once it was dusk and the tent was illuminated, it would indeed look like a party far out in the wilds of the African plains. The savannah was eerily beautiful, a 92-acre parcel of grassland with a few gnarled but majestic trees. Sankaty Head Lighthouse and a thin strip of ocean were visible beyond. The caterers were setting up. The bartender polished glasses. Phoebe had her hair done in a twist. She was wearing a silver silk Anjali Kumar dress and a funky necklace of silver rope with silver and clear beads. She was wearing silver flats out of respect for the savannah itself. Phoebe was nervous. She had actually held her prescription of Valium in her palm and rattled it, wondering what to do. Take one? Last summer, it would have been unthinkable to attend any social event without taking two Valiums, or preferably three. But last summer, and the 6 summers before, nothing had been expected of her. Tonight, she had an announcement to make. 15 minutes before the guests were to arrive, Jennifer handed Phoebe a glass of champagne. Just one sip, Phoebe thought. One sip would taste good. Jennifer smiled at Phoebe. She was about to say something flattering. Jennifer, for whatever reason, thought Phoebe was fabulous, despite her 8-year hiatus in the netherworld. And Jennifer's faith in her gave her faith in herself. This night was going to be a watershed for Phoebe. First of all, Jennifer said, thanks for helping. The party looks beautiful. It was nothing, Phoebe said. She meant this. Pulling the party together had been a layup. But Phoebe newly appreciated her gift for organizing this kind of thing. She had impeccable taste, and no detail escaped her. What you're doing for your friends is so amazing and generous, Jennifer said. Well, Phoebe said, I'm just sorry you didn't know them. They were amazing and generous themselves. Tears welled up, and she blotted the corners of her eyes with a cocktail napkin. Okay, this cannot happen when I'm making my speech. Amen, Jennifer said, and they clinked glasses. The band started up. Phoebe had asked for Sinatra, Dean Martin, Bobby Darin, all the oldies. She wanted a real old-fashioned feel to this party. She wanted it to evoke an era gone by, the country club parties that her grandparents used to attend. The cocktail of the evening was the Savannah Sidecar. The caterers were passing Devils on Horseback, Pimento Cheese Toasts, Clams Casino, Classic Shrimp Cocktail, mini lamb chops with mint jelly, and gougères. People streamed in along a temporary walkway lined with luminaries. Phoebe and Jennifer stood at the entrance to the tent and greeted everybody. Phoebe talked with people she hadn't seen in years. She had studied the guest list. The trick was pinning the right names to the right people. She was listening to herself and was impressed. She was charming. She was funny. She wanted the party never to end. She would find something else to chair, she decided. She would follow in her grandmother's footsteps and be a philanthropist and hostess. It was her calling. Suddenly, Addison was upon her. She took stock. He was wearing khaki pants, white shirt, navy blazer, Madras bow tie. Phoebe had insisted on the bow tie. He was wearing loafers with no socks. His hair, what there was of it, was combed. He smelled like aftershave and Jack Daniels. It was odd to see him this way, approaching her like any other party guest. It made him seem like a stranger. Phoebe remembered the spring she'd met Addison and how much she had adored him. He was balding, true, and he was divorced from a notorious socialite and had a baby daughter. He was not quite what she had imagined for herself. She had imagined someone like Reed. But Addison was rich, and he was charismatic. He was seasoned. He had lived in other countries and done interesting things.
He understood the way the world worked, and he wanted to show Phoebe. She knew herself well enough to know that she needed someone older. This had ended up benefiting her. Addison had been strong enough for both of them. He was able to endure. That he had eventually fallen in love with Tess only showed that he was human after all. It also showed Phoebe how deeply she'd been buried. And despite Tess, Addison had not left her. She would thank him for that someday. She wished she could greet Addison with the same enthusiasm and joie de vivre she greeted everyone else with, or she wished she could greet him with the kind of secret, quiet love that her grandmother always reserved for her grandfather. She had bloomed in his presence and wilted in his absence, even after 60 years of marriage. But what Phoebe felt when she saw Addison was concern, weariness, a dash of contempt, a dash of pride, a dash of hope. How many drinks at home? She wondered. He bent to kiss Jennifer first, out of courtesy, and then Phoebe. "Looks great," he said, of the tent, she supposed. The contempt popped up, like a bottle Phoebe had been trying to hold underwater. "How many drinks have you had?" she whispered. He smiled at her fondly, but it was an act. He held up one finger and moved into the tent. "One," she thought. Which meant two, or more likely, three. The chief and Andrea arrived a little while later. To Phoebe's delight and her considerable surprise, they looked sensational. Normally, when they went out on the town, they wore neutral colors. The chief often wore a gray suit that he'd bought off the rack at Anderson Little in 1989. Phoebe teased him mercilessly about that suit, but it didn't matter. She loved Eddie, bad suit and all. Andrea normally wore boring beige or black. Tonight, however, Andrea had on a red silk halter dress and red sandals, and Ed wore navy pants, a white shirt, and a blue and white seersucker jacket. The Capenashes might have raided Phoebe and Addison's own closets. They looked so dashing. Phoebe did a little dance, waving her arms in the air. The champagne was going to her head. "You look gorgeous," Phoebe said to Andrea. Andrea smiled, but Phoebe sensed impatience. She had to tone it down, or she was going to scare them away like two beautiful, exotic birds. "You look gorgeous too, Eddie. Thank you for coming."
"Wouldn't have missed it," the chief said.
"Where did you get the dress?" Phoebe asked Andrea.
"Hepburn."
"You're breathtaking."
"Well," Andrea said, rolling her eyes.
"I'm honored you're here," Phoebe said.
Andrea nodded matter-of-factly, as though to say, "You should be." The chief, however, squeezed Phoebe's arm and leaned in to kiss her cheek.
"The tent looks great.
I'm ready for a Savannah sidecar. Where's Addison?"
"In there somewhere," Phoebe said, waving into the tent. "I have a really big surprise for later, okay? Try to stand near the front when I take the microphone."
"A surprise?"
the chief said.
"Big one," Phoebe said.
Andrea smiled again, but Phoebe could see the balloon over her head, and the words in the balloon said, "Whoop-de-doo." At 8 o'clock, Phoebe and Jennifer left their posts by the door and wandered inside to enjoy the party themselves. The band was playing In the Mood, and the first guests had started dancing. Phoebe was offered a devil on horseback. What was it exactly? A date stuffed with soft white cheese wrapped in bacon, glazed with brown sugar and Worcestershire.
"Really?"
Phoebe said. She had picked it off the catering menu because it had sounded old-fashioned. Phoebe ate it.
It was delicious.
She was supposed to make her remarks at 8:30, but she didn't want to speak until everyone had arrived,
and Jeffrey and Delilah were still at large, which went to show how backward everything was this summer. Delilah was normally the first one to arrive anywhere and the last one to leave. She loved to gather, whether it was a fancy event like this one, or the kids' holiday sing, or a sandwich picnic out at Smith's Point. Delilah thrived when she was being social. She loved good conversation. She sought gossip. She savored food and drink. She loved music. She always danced, dragging Jeffrey onto the floor against his wishes. She did not like to miss one single second of the action. And if she did, then she had to hear what she'd missed in excruciating detail, so she felt like she'd been there. But not this summer. This summer, Delilah stayed home. There was no longer anything worth gossiping about. She ate Pop-Tarts and pizza and drank Diet Dr. Pepper like a person who lived in a trailer park. Delilah reminded Phoebe of a doll she had had as a child. This doll, Annabelle her name was, had an off-on switch at the nape of her neck. When the doll was on, she giggled and cooed, she gulped her bottle and let out a healthy belch. When the doll was off, she lay there, blank and mute. Delilah had been turned off. At 8:30, Jeffrey and Delilah still had not arrived. Phoebe, though she'd promised herself she wouldn't, called the house. Answering machine. Were they on their way? She would wait 5 more minutes. 10 minutes passed, and Jennifer touched Phoebe's back.
You have to speak. People are getting ready to leave.
Leave? Already?
The early birds. You have to do it now while you have your audience.
But Phoebe didn't have her audience. She needed Jeffrey and Delilah. She checked the entrance to the tent.
They wouldn't skip it, would they?
They had bought tickets. Phoebe had spoken to Delilah yesterday morning. Phoebe had said, I'll see you tomorrow night. And Delilah had responded affirmatively, tomorrow night.
Were they blowing it off?
It would be an infraction from which the friendship would never recover. But Phoebe herself had committed so many infractions. Just then she saw Jeffrey enter the tent. His face was very brown. It was farmer brown. He wore Nantucket Reds, a white shirt with navy stripes, a double-breasted navy blazer. Jeffrey always looked good. It was Cornell, Phoebe thought. Jeffrey always looked like he was attending an Ivy League garden party. She hurried over to him.
I'm so glad you're here, she said. Where's Delilah?
He frowned. He had a prominent brow, which knit itself into an expression Phoebe couldn't read. Exasperation? Fear?
She didn't come? Phoebe said.
She'll be here, he said. She's coming late.
May I have your attention, please?
Jennifer had taken the microphone from the band leader and was standing in the middle of the dance floor, waiting for the crowd to quiet down. Someone tapped a glass with a spoon. There were overlapping, shushing noises.
Shh.
Phoebe turned, panicked.
Wait, Delilah wasn't here. She wasn't here yet. She was coming late, but not before Phoebe had to speak.
Phoebe scanned the crowd for Addison, Andrea, and the chief.
Where were they?
She couldn't find them. When she had imagined this moment, she imagined the 5 of them lined up across the front. She imagined making her announcement, and watching their faces pop open in private fireworks, happiness, surprise, joy. Maybe they would cry poignant, touching tears.
Now this wouldn't happen. Would it still be okay?
Phoebe had planned this party so thoroughly, every detail, down to the selection of the hors d'oeuvres, the choice of songs, the color of the balloons. And yet she hadn't been able to make things go the way she wanted them to.
First of all, I'd like to thank everyone for coming. This is a very special night.
Phoebe looked at Jeffrey. He lifted a cocktail off a passing tray and took a deep drink.
There are so many people we'd like to thank,
for the delicious food and wine Mark and Etney Yell of the Nantucket Catering Company.
Phoebe looked around. She saw a splash of red in the corner of the tent. Andrea? Was the chief with her? Would they move forward when it was Phoebe's turn to speak? And where was Addison?
Phoebe now rued her decision not to tell him what she'd done, but she had wanted him to be surprised, just like everyone else.
I'd like to thank Sperry Tents and the Perry Rossi Orchestra.
Applause.
But the real force behind tonight's festivities is our dedicated chairperson. This woman gave hours of her precious time, as well as donating her considerable talent, her keen eye for detail, and her unparalleled organizational skills. They had a rule in the group, no gifts. They'd had that rule from the beginning.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mrs. Phoebe Wheeler.
Applause. As Phoebe made her way to the front, the people standing around her cleared a path. She would be okay. She'd had only one glass of champagne, and she hadn't succumbed to the lure of the Valium. She would stay focused. Delilah wasn't there, but Phoebe couldn't worry about that now. Her heart was thudding. She had a case of the shakes. Deep breath. She took the microphone. It had been a long time since she had spoken in public, but she could do it. She had won a $50 savings bond in the Junior Miss Pageant for poise and appearance. Poise. She had stood on her high school stage and announced Reed and Shelby Duncan as prom king and queen.
Thank you, Phoebe said.
She gazed out over the crowd. Faces, collars, necklaces, cleavage, hands holding drinks, legs, shoes, hairspray, perfume, cigarette smoke, Jack Daniels. They were just people. They all had hearts and lungs and tear ducts just like she did. She saw Andrea and the chief in the back corner with Addison. Jeffrey approached them. No Delilah, but Phoebe couldn't let her mind wander.
As you know, one of the goals of island conservation is to create nature walks through our properties where such walks are appropriate, where families can best learn about the topography and the flora and fauna of the island without disturbing it. We have long wanted to create such a walk here on the savannah.
She paused. She did not look at Andrea or Addison. She looked up front, at Jennifer beaming, at Jennifer's husband, Swede, at Hank, who owned the sailboat, and his glamorous French girlfriend, Legree.
In June, I lost two dear friends in a sailing accident. They were schoolteachers here on the island who left behind 7-year-old twins.
The crowd quieted. The tent was silent. 300 people held their breath.
And I decided I would like to honor my friends by underwriting the cost of the Savannah Nature Walk and naming it after them. So in September, work will begin on a 3-mile loop that will be known as the Tess and Greg McAvoy Nature Walk.
Phoebe smiled. Had she said that correctly?
She thought she had.
There was thundering applause. Someone whistled. Phoebe had an ending line. I hope you and your families will treasure this walk in years to come. But there wasn't going to be a chance to add this. The orchestra launched into Dionne Warwick's Walk On By, as Phoebe had requested, and Phoebe relinquished the microphone. She stepped back into the crowd, and Jennifer hugged her and handed her a fresh glass of champagne.
We are all so excited about this, she said.
Phoebe felt like she was going to faint.
She said, I have to find, and she wandered away. She meandered through the crowd, but these were her 15 minutes of fame. She was the party's it girl. People wanted to talk to her.
A woman with butterscotch-colored hair and a beauty parlor do grabbed her arm and said,
My God, Phoebe, you're such an angel, doing something like that in memory of your friends and their children. Are the children still here, on island?
Yes, Phoebe said. They live with their aunt and uncle now.
God bless them,
the woman said.
and God bless you.
Thank you, Phoebe said. She didn't want any congratulations, and she did not want to be thought generous. Naming the trail had cost her $225,000, but she and Addison had money just sitting in the bank accruing interest, and they had nothing meaningful to spend it on. Phoebe wanted to give Greg and Tess a piece of Nantucket. She wanted the twins to be able to walk the Savannah Trail and see the beauty of the island and feel like Tess and Greg were still alive. Or if nothing that mystical happened, fine. At least the twins would feel like their parents had been remembered and honored. Phoebe had come up with the idea in her sleep. She had been thinking of Reed and the scholarship at Whitefish Bay High School, and how happy it made her father, Phil, to hand a graduating senior a check for $6,000 each spring. Phoebe shook hands with five eager-faced strangers standing in a semicircle. She bumped into Dr. Richard Flanders, the school superintendent, who enveloped her in the folds of his considerable person. She could smell his aftershave, and her right arm was cut off from the rest of her body, and she feared her missing arm was going to spill her champagne, or even drop it. "That's a great thing you did," Flanders said. Phoebe said, "Thank you." This didn't feel right. She should have donated the money for the path anonymously, but that hadn't been possible because of the Tess and Greg connection. So now she was saddled with her good deed. It was making her uncomfortable in a way she hadn't predicted. She saw her people, her dear friends and her husband, huddled together with their backs turned aggressively to everyone else, including the server, who was trying to offer the chief a stuffed quail egg. They were talking among themselves in a serious, deliberate way that Phoebe had seen before. They had talked that way when Tess and Greg died. They had talked that way when Tess lost her baby. They had probably talked that way on September 11th, when they realized Reed had died. They had closed ranks and were speaking in undertones. Phoebe suddenly understood why they had the rule of no gifts. It was too complicated emotionally to give and receive things when there were so many tight, overlapping connections between the eight of them. They were too close, and gifts required fairness and reciprocity. Here you go, this is for you. Oh, thank you, I love it. A simple idea, but not simple with them. Gifts would inevitably cause a mess. Phoebe had caused a mess. They found her gift offensive. They were offended that Phoebe had thought of this tribute and then executed it without their input. Andrea, of course, would never allow Tess's and Greg's names to be attached to something without her approval. Addison would be pissed because Phoebe had spent nearly $250,000 without asking him. But she was prepared for this. Some of that money was money that she'd earned herself and then invested wisely with Reed. Still, Tess had been Addison's lover. He was the executor of the will. Tess and Greg belonged to him. And they belonged to Andrea. But that, in a way, was why Phoebe had done this secretly. Tess and Greg had been Phoebe's friends, too, and she wanted to honor them her way, without input from the people whose connections to them were believed to be more important. Phoebe broke into the circle, ready for her flogging. Sure enough, Andrea was crying. "I'm sorry," Phoebe said. Andrea swiped at her nose. "It was beautiful," she said. "A beautiful gesture." Jeffrey said, "Delilah is going to kick herself for missing it." Addison pulled Phoebe in close and kissed her temple. "You're a genius," he said. Andrea. By 9 o'clock, she felt she had done her duty. She had drunk 2 glasses of Chardonnay, she had eaten 6 hors d'oeuvres, she had listened to Phoebe's speech, which honored Tess and Greg in a way that Andrea herself should have thought of, had she not been so pathetically inward-looking, and she had wept a few tears without breaking down. She had even danced with Eddie to their favorite Sinatra tune. In Andrea's mind, she deserved a Bronze Star for outstanding courage. But now she was ready to go. "Already?" Ed said. "It's only 5 minutes to 9. The band is playing until midnight."
The thought of having to hold herself together for 3 more hours nearly brought Andrea to her knees.
I want to go home, she said.
Another hour, Ed said.
Now, Andrea said.
Poor Casey.
Delilah's not even here yet, so poor Casey nothing. And when the twins do get home, she'll put them to bed and make $15 an hour for watching TV.
Ed, Andrea said, I can't stay.
Addison approached them, holding a drink. He was glassy-eyed.
Are you drunk? Andrea said.
Exhausted, he said. I haven't been sleeping. Something on your mind? The chief asked.
Addison said, If I thought I could sneak out of here without Phoebe's beheading me, I would.
My savior, Andrea said. Will you take me home?
The chief's eyes lit up.
Would you mind?
Not at all, Addison said. You're okay to drive? The chief asked.
I'm okay.
I'll drive, Andrea said. Are you coming back? The chief asked Addison.
Not if I can help it, Addison said. Phoebe has her own car. She came early. She has to stay late.
I'll stay with Phoebe, the chief said, and Jeffrey. And Delilah is coming.
She better be, Andrea said. She doesn't get a free pass to miss this if I don't.
We'll cover for you, the chief said. He kissed Andrea goodbye. Andrea took off her shoes and walked barefoot with Addison to his car. Addison was whistling, as happy as she was to be sprung free. They climbed into his Mercedes, which had deep, soft seats and the intoxicating smell of expensive leather. There was an empty highball glass in the console.
You drank on the way out here? She asked.
He said,
Don't tell the chief.
She said, Well, please don't kill us on the way home. He said, Would it really matter if I did? She looked out the window at the moors rushing by. It was a beautiful night. There was a moon. The party had been nice. Phoebe's gift was inspired. And yet Andrea had a hard time feeling anything. Would it matter if she died tonight? She said, Tess had a lover. Her breath put a mist on the car window. Addison said, Do you want to come to my house and have a glass of wine?
Okay, she said.
Jeffrey. Phoebe was the star of the evening, and it was good to see. She was glowing like her old self. She caught Jeffrey's eye, pulled away from a group of people he didn't know, and glided over to him. Her dress was silver, and her eyes picked up some of the sparkle.
Where is your wife? She said.
Jeffrey checked his watch. Her plane gets in at 9:15.
Her plane? Phoebe said.
She took the kids to the movies, Jeffrey said.
The movies? Phoebe said. Why tonight?
Jeffrey shrugged. It was hard to explain to someone who didn't have kids. Tonight was the night. Anyway, I'm going to get her at the airport. I'll be back with her in half an hour.
You'd better be, Phoebe said. The band is playing until midnight.
Jeffrey got to the airport at 9:10. It was a Friday night in August, and the place was abuzz. Plane loads of businessmen from New York, Boston, Washington, walked into the terminal and were greeted by pretty wives, shouting children, frenzied golden retrievers on leashes. Jeffrey had had 2 cocktails at the party, which had affected him oddly. He was unaccountably anxious. He wanted to see his wife come off the plane with the 4 kids. There had been moments today when he had questioned his own good judgment about letting Delilah go in the first place. Was she mentally stable enough to travel with 4 kids? She had seemed better the night before. She had cooked, they had made love, eaten the pie. It had been fine, it would be fine. Jeffrey had no reason to worry, but he wished he'd stuck to beer. He sat and sat.
The stream of businessmen slowed to a trickle, then stopped. Jeffrey looked at the clock. It was 9:45. He checked at both airlines. Any more planes coming? No, sir, that was the last section. Jeffrey called Delilah's cell phone. The call went straight to voicemail. He called their house. No answer. Then he called the Kapanash house. Casey answered the phone. Casey? Jeffrey said. Is Delilah there? Are the kids there? No, she said. They're not home yet. Has Delilah called you? No, Casey said. She said they'd be on the 9:00 flight. I'm at the airport, Jeffrey said. I've been here 40 minutes. They weren't on any of the planes. And you called Delilah? Got her voicemail, Jeffrey said. He hadn't talked to her since that morning. Okay, let me try to find her. Jeffrey called Delilah's phone again, and again was shuttled to voicemail. God damn it, Delilah, call me, he said. He couldn't go back to the party without her. Phoebe would be angry. The lovely balance she'd achieved would possibly collapse in a lopsided heap of unnecessary worry and upset. And so he went home. He hated drama. That was the farmer in him. He liked things that were steady and reliable. The seasons, weather that fell into patterns that could be predicted, cycles of the earth. Plant a seed, watch it grow and bear fruit, harvest the fruit, allow the plant to wither, die, and nourish the soil for the next planted seed. Of course, there would be a reasonable explanation. They had missed the showing of the movie they were supposed to see, so they had to wait for the next showing. Delilah got stuck in traffic on the way home, or they got sidetracked by a Chuck E. Cheese or a roadside fair and missed the last flight. And Delilah, as usual, did not make sure her cell phone was charged, and it ran out of power. Fine. But he did not feel fine. What he felt was a gnawing sense of unrest. Since Tess and Greg had died, their home life had been a brewing storm. Jeffrey knew this, but he was busy at the farm. It was August. Jeffrey had always maintained that there was no difference between July and August, other than that July was corn and August was tomatoes, but every day the farm market proved him wrong. The place was packed. The line at the deli was 12 people long. Joanna, the baker, was making 5 dozen triple berry pies a day, and the corn bin was filled with 300 fresh-picked ears 1 minute and empty an hour later. Jeffrey couldn't focus on anything but survival. Pick the corn, the herbs, the flowers, the beets and cucumbers and summer squash and zucchini and carrots, the lettuce and kale and turnips. Tend to the gourds and the pumpkins, the dahlias and chrysanthemums. Water, reap, sow. Pray that Delilah would hang in there until January, when Jeffrey took 4 weeks off and could give proper attention to her emotional crisis. But he wasn't an idiot. He had sensed that things were about to break. He was watching out of the corner of his eye. Delilah was a pendulum, manic and hyper-alert 1 minute, weepy and despondent the next. Why on earth had he let her take the kids off the island? At home, the house was quiet. He opened the fridge and found it clean and stacked with food. Was Delilah planning a party? Had she meant to have people over here after the event? There was a case of cold Heineken lined up like green glass soldiers in the bottom drawer, and Jeffrey grabbed one. There was a note on the kitchen counter, which he hadn't seen when he'd rushed in at 6:30 to get dressed. A note? It was a regular white index card. Written in black Sharpie, it said, "This does not mean I don't love you. I do. That's forever. Yes, and for always." He read the index card again. It was a lyric from Sweet, Judy Blue Eyes. Greg used to sing the song all the damn time, and Delilah sang along in harmony. The first third of the suite was, in Delilah's estimation, the most perfect song ever written. She would look at Jeffrey and sing, I am yours, you are mine, you are what you are, you make it hard. Was this note meant for him? It was in Delilah's handwriting. Was it old, or had she meant for him to find it tonight? He tried her cell phone again. You have to go, no matter what. Promise me. The back of his throat ached. He went upstairs to the boys' rooms. In both rooms, the beds looked like they had been made up by chambermaids at the Ritz-Carlton. The dressers were tidy, drawers pushed all the way closed. He opened the drawers. Were there clothes missing? The drawers did look empty-ish, as they tended to when Delilah let the laundry slide. Jeffrey took a deep breath. He did not like drama, nor did he like to jump to conclusions. But he didn't like the way things were stacking up. A fridge full of food, the clean house, pretty beds, neat dressers, the note. He had thought things were getting better. He had congratulated himself. He had waited out Delilah's instability and the storm had cleared. Delilah was correcting. But no. Addison. The house was impeccably clean, but Addison straightened up anyway. He wiped dust out of a wine glass. Andrea drank Chardonnay. Addison had a whole wine cooler full of whites, and there on the bottom shelf were two bottles of his favorite Meursault, the wine he and Tess had drunk at lunch at Nu Deux, the wine Addison swore he would never drink again. He opened the bottle. Tess had a lover. He looked in the pantry for snacks. Mixed nuts, a box of Bremner wafers. Did they have any cheese? He checked the fridge. No cheese. He tasted the Meursault, poured a glass for Andrea, then decided he would pour a glass for himself, even though he had vowed never to drink it again. He handed Andrea her glass and put the nuts in a bowl. Andrea said nothing. He should put on music. He said, "Where should we sit?" She said, "Oh, Jesus, Ad, I don't give a shit." This was somehow exactly the right answer. It struck the right tone. They were going to be frank with each other. Addison was going to suggest they sit out by the pool, but that seemed too pleasant. There were two bar stools at the counter. Addison sat, then Andrea sat, and Addison set the bowl of nuts equidistant between them. "So," he said. "Let's not talk," Andrea said. "Let's just drink for a while." Addison nodded. Fair enough, he thought. The effects of 6 Jack Daniels had hit him. He was now officially drunk. Andrea probably needed 10 more drinks before she was ready to hear what he had to tell her. But Addison couldn't wait. He said, "I was having an affair with Tess. I was in love with her." Andrea drank her wine. She said nothing. She drank the whole glass in 3 minutes. Addison was timing her. He refilled her glass. His hand was shaking. He wanted her to say something, but he was afraid of what she would say. "I'm sorry," he said to Tess. He felt 100 pounds lighter. He felt like he could take the back stairs 2 at a time and leap across the swimming pool. Andrea was staring into space. Her face was halfway between contempt and what he thought might be relief. Andrea was tough and always had been. Addison tried to remember when the two of them had ever been alone together like this for any length of time. In Vegas, they had sought out the slot machines together. Andrea had been feeding the machine next to his when he hit for $1,700. She had been the first person to hug him and jump up and down as the machine blinked his good fortune. On September 11th, she had come to the hospital where the doctor was examining Phoebe after her miscarriage. She had hugged Addison and moaned with him. She had checked in every day for weeks, stopping by with homemade soup and donuts from the Downy Flake.
Addison remembered wandering with Andrea through the National Gallery in London. They had stopped in front of Renoir's painting, Les Parapluies. And then there was the time Addison and Andrea had taken the surfing lesson in Sayulita, Mexico, with a grungy expat named Kelso. Addison broke the silence by saying, "Do you remember that surfing lesson we took?" She did not respond. Addison had been the most unlikely surfing partner in existence, but the chief and Jeffrey, in their stoic, stony way, had flat out refused. And Greg was such a good surfer already that he didn't want or need to take a beginner lesson. Phoebe was too prissy. Delilah was too uncoordinated. And Tess was afraid of the water. Which left Addison. Andrea pleaded, "Come on, I've never asked you for anything." He gave in because she was correct. She had never asked him for anything. Together they donned wetsuits and paddled out on their boards to chest-high water, where Kelso, the goateed, tattooed, pierced, stoned surf instructor, pushed them into waves. Andrea stood first, then, 100 tries later, Addison stood. It had been a revelation, riding the water like that, even for a few seconds before the inevitable crash. He and Andrea had talked about it with Kelso over beers at the cantina later. As they were finishing their bottle of wine, it had taken them 32 minutes, the phone rang. Addison checked. It was Jeffrey. He said, "Should I answer it?" Andrea said, "Do you think now's really the time?" He said, "Would you like me to open another bottle of wine?" She said, "Please." He opened the wine. The house was dark. Too dark to see the elephant in the room. He said, "Are we going to talk about it?" She said, "I'm curious. Why bring up the surfing lesson?" "I don't know. It just came to mind. It was something you and I did together." She said, "You went with me when no one else would. It was no big deal. I had fun." She said, "Why didn't you tell me about Tess earlier?" Addison said, "Is that not obvious?" "Tess," Andrea said, but she couldn't go on. The name hung there in the dark house. The name was nothing more than a breath. "I knew there was someone. I figured it out, finally. While she was alive, I thought there was something wrong. I thought it was me." "You?" "She stopped going to church with me. Said she was finished with the Lord. Then I caught her lying about where she'd been and what she'd been doing, and my feelings were hurt. I didn't understand." Addison reached for matches. He lit a few candles on the bar. Andrea said, "Just recently I figured out it wasn't me. I figured out it was somebody else." "It was me." "It was you." Andrea shook her head. "Jesus, Ad, what were you thinking?" "I was thinking I loved her."
"You loved her?"
Andrea said.
"Loved her, adored her, worshipped her."
Andrea nodded. Her eyes were blazing in the candlelight. She reminded him of a lynx or a panther.
"I would thank you for that, if it weren't so wrong. What were your plans?"
"I wanted her to leave, Greg. I wanted to live with her, marry her."
"Did she want that?"
"No," he said. "If I were to be very honest with myself, I would have to say, I don't think she did." Andrea nodded, nose in her wine glass. Addison felt a shadow covering his head and shoulders, like a big, scary presence lurking behind him. He had never meant to disclose everything, but he saw now that it would be pointless to tell some, but not all. "I wanted her to tell Greg about us on the sail. I asked her to tell him."
"To tell him on their anniversary?"
"I thought it would be a good time. They were going to be alone, without the kids."
"Do you think she did it?"
Andrea asked.
I have this feeling, Addison said. God, he had waited so long to say this, just say it, that she told him and he killed her. Silence in the house. The candles flickered. And that would make it my fault, Addison said.
Delilah. She drove and drove. She crossed the state line into New York. Now she was officially kidnapping. At every exit, she thought, I should turn around. But it felt too good to be headed away from Nantucket. It felt good to be putting miles between her and the sight of her agony. After she drove through Albany, she had to decide if she wanted to cross the state on the thruway or via the southern tier. Which would be safer? She suspected the thruway would have more troopers. She chose the southern route. Leather stocking land, the stomping grounds of James Fenimore Cooper. It was literary, the path they were taking. Literary? She was crazy. As long as she knew she was crazy, she was sane, right? Delilah was monitoring herself for signs of exhaustion. She had awoken that morning at 5 when Jeffrey left for the farm. She had gotten out of bed at 6 to go to the grocery store. It seemed impossible that this was still the same day. 10:30, 11:15. Her heartbeat was irregular. By now, Jeffrey would realize she was gone. Her cell phone was in her purse, but she had shut it off, and she decided she would not check it to see what it contained. She was both giddy and profoundly terrified. Her actions were irresponsible, criminal even, but what could not be explained were the dual monsters of her grief and her guilt. She had to try to outrun them. She had no idea where they were headed. She wanted to start over. She wanted another life. The life she'd been given, she had ruined. Where could she get a new life? The first place that popped into her head was Sayulita, Mexico. She would put the kids in school. They would learn to speak Espanol. They would learn to surf. They would become as brown as the natives. 4 sophisticated expat children. Delilah would open a fish taco stand. She would not take the kids to Mexico. She would take them to South Haven, Michigan, the town where she had grown up, the house where her parents still lived. Was that where she was headed? Could Delilah show up on the Victorian porch of the Ashby homestead with 4 kids, 2 of them not her own? Would her mother let them in? Would she bake cookies and show the kids the path down to the lake? Lake Michigan was as big as the ocean. They could pick blueberries, take day trips to Saugatuck and Holland. Delilah could sleep in her childhood bed with Chloe next to her and the boys in air mattresses on the floor, and Delilah would finally be safe to think. Ironic that the place she had run away from as a teenager was the place she was now running to. But it made sense, right? In a circular kind of way? There was a stirring in the back. Barney, of course. Mom, he said. She would have to come up with a way to explain this. We're going to visit your grandparents. We're going on a road trip. It's an American summertime tradition. She couldn't frighten them. She had to pick her words so carefully. Yes? Delilah said. I'm right here, babe. There was a noise. A yelp, a bark, a splutter, a splash. A stink. A strangled cry. Delilah inhaled sharply. Oh, no. Yes. Again a retching sound, a spewing forth. Barney was sick. He was vomiting. He had thrown up all over the back of the car, all over his legs, all over Chloe's legs. Oh, God, the stench. He was gagging or choking. 1/2 gallon of 7-Up or whatever toxic green elixir he'd ordered. 2 pounds of popcorn floating in coconut oil, chunks of red licorice. Delilah had long suspected that Twizzlers were made out of plastic,
and were therefore indigestible.
"Mom,"
he cried out.
"I'm right here," she said. "We're stopping."
She pulled off at the next exit, where there was a Holiday Inn. They were in the town of Cobleskill. Delilah told herself this was okay. She would not panic. She parked the car and turned around. Puke everywhere. Oh, God, the minivan. It would never be the same. Barney was covered with radioactive goo. He was crying. She wanted to hug him, hold him, wash him, throw his clothes away, tuck him into a clean bed. But he had to wait. But he was only 6. Could he wait? "I have to leave you here. I'll be right back. I'm going in that door right there to get us a hotel room, and then I'll be back, okay?"
"No,"
he howled. He was sobbing. Her baby. Her darling. She could not leave him even for the 10 minutes it would take to check into the hotel. Drew opened his eyes. He said,
"Go ahead, Mom. You get us a room. I'll stay here with Barn."
Delilah did not wait to see if this offer was satisfactory to Barney. She hopped out of the car and hightailed it inside. She seemed to have brought the funky underbelly of the movie house smell with her. Barney had puked in her hair. It would be Murphy's Law that during the times when you most needed a capable front desk person to expedite your hotel check-in, at midnight, say, when you had a barfing child in the car, what you ended up with was an incompetent moron. The dude moved in slow motion, exactly like the fake-out trick the Wunderkids used against the villains. Delilah was so fatigued that for a second she became confused. Was this actually part of the movie she had just not watched? The guy was lanky and had the wispy, flyaway hair of a mad professor. He was a sallow yellow color with even yellower teeth, and his nose was as big as a wedge of cheese. His name tag said Lonnie, a sad, outdated name that fit him. Lonnie slid a form across the desk that Delilah was supposed to fill out. She had to get the kids in a room. Hurry. After God knows what further processing, moving so slowly it was like going backward, Lonnie slid her key cards across the desk.
"Room 432, second floor, all the way in the back. The easiest way to access it is to..."
"Yes, yes," she said. She could find it. Of course, it sounded like Lonnie had just assigned her the room that was the farthest point away from the parking lot. She hurried back out to the car. She had visions of some demented personality driving away with the kids while she was inside, kidnapping them from the kidnapper. She scooped up Barney, sacrificing her own clothes. She woke the other kids, and they trailed her like sheep. They marched the chilly halls of the Holiday Inn, which was sinister in its lack of character. Barney had his legs wrapped around Delilah's waist and his hot, foul-smelling mouth agape against her neck. She had not had a spare hand for the overnight bag. She would have to retrace her steps the 1.5 miles back to the car. She would strip Barney first, put him in the shower, a nightmarish thought, the kid hated the shower, and pile him into bed with his brother. She found room 432, the last godforsaken room, but blessedly right across the hall from the ice machine and vending, and she tried to negotiate the key into its slot without being able to see her hands. Somehow she got the door open and stepped inside. There was a bathroom to the immediate left, a short hallway with an open closet, shelves for an iron and a dry cleaning bag, 2 double beds, a TV on the dresser, a desk, a table, 2 chairs, a pastel painting of a windmill and a couple of hounds, a window with long, heavy brocade curtains, and an air conditioner turned up full blast. The room was about 35 degrees.
"Okay,"
Delilah said. Here was shelter.
"Auntie Dee?"
It was Finn. She turned around to address what sounded like panic in his voice, just in time to see him spew a great green wave of vomit in the vicinity of the brown plastic trash can, but really, it splattered all over the dresser.
"Bathroom!" Delilah barked.
She sounded unsympathetic, she knew.
But Jesus, what was happening here?
She laid Barney down and wheeled Finn into the bathroom, lifting the toilet seat and pushing his head down just in time for the next pulsing gush to splash into the bowl. Chloe moved to the far bed, unaware or unimpressed, took off her shoes, and climbed in.
Teeth,
Delilah thought. Chloe needed to brush her teeth, but Delilah had to deal with first things first, and besides that, the toothbrushes were in the overnight bag. Drew stood next to Delilah and said,
"Mom?
Are you going to puke too?"
she asked.
"No," he said.
"Okay, good."
She knew he wanted direction. He wanted to help. 8 years old and already a troubleshooter. Did she need to say it? He was just like his father. Delilah said,
"Are you capable of getting your brother out of his clothes?"
Drew nodded like a good soldier.
"You bet."
Delilah bent down to stroke Finn's back. This was her fault. She could not take kids who were used to just picked corn and organic free-range chickens and expect their systems to handle near poisonous quantities of sugar and tallow.
If Jeffrey were watching this.
She tried to push this thought from her head.
He would say she was getting what she deserved.
The minivan was covered with puke. The hotel room had been desecrated, and they'd only been there 90 seconds. She, Delilah, was streaked with vomit. She had vomit in her hair. She heard a familiar tussling in the room, and she knew that although Barney was parched and dehydrated, or possibly brewing another bubbling batch of barf, he was also actively resisting his older brother's stripping him down. Drew insisted.
"Mom said."
Barney said, "Get off of me." Delilah left Finn moaning and groaning and separated her boys. She whipped off Barney's clothes with no mercy while Drew complained.
"You said I could help."
She threw the fouled clothes into a pile in the corner. What she needed was the overnight bag from the car. Could she in good conscience send Drew to go get it? He was strapping and athletic. He could deal with the car keys and the hotel key card. He could get the bag and trek all the way back here. But could he do it in the middle of the night when, Delilah was sure, there were abductors and pedophiles lurking in the fields beyond the hotel parking lot? No. "I have to go get the overnight bag," Delilah said. She wanted her toothbrush, and the kids needed a change of clothes. Delilah waited until Finn was strong enough to stand up. Then she walked him to the bed where his sister was fast asleep, stripped him to his boxers, and got him under the covers. She adjusted the air conditioner. The room was starting to smell. Delilah threw a few of the thin hotel towels over the obvious places where Finn had vomited. "I'll be right back," Delilah said to Drew. Barney was huddled under the covers.
"Can I watch TV?"
Drew asked.
"No," Delilah said. It was 1 a.m. What would be on the hotel TV but pornography?
"Please."
"No, Drew. Everyone else is asleep."
He gave her a face.
"This place sucks. I hate it here."
Well, that made two of them. But Delilah couldn't articulate this because the kids would take their cues from her. She had to be upbeat no matter what.
"I only pulled over because your brother was sick. This isn't any place we're staying."
"Where are we staying?" Drew asked. "Where are we going?"
Michigan, she thought. The idea had taken root in her. The kids splashing in the lake, the kids picking blueberries. "Someplace else," she said.
She hiked down to the parking lot for the bag. She was exhausted, really fucking tired. She just wanted to sleep. When she got back to the room, she heard a noise she did not like. The door to the bathroom was shut. She pushed it open. Drew was on his knees, puking into the bathtub. Phoebe. Everyone had left her, except for the chief and the 100 other people who were dancing. Phoebe had no shortage of dance partners. She danced with Swede. She danced with Hank Drenmiller. She danced with the executive director of Island Conservation. They all told her how wonderful she was, how generous and kind-hearted. Phoebe felt like the belle of the ball, the way she used to feel on special nights before Reed died, like she was pretty and charming and so, so lucky to have been born into her life. But something was eating at her, an imposter feeling, a feeling that she did not deserve any of this. She had been drinking champagne all night to combat this feeling, but as was always the case with alcohol, her underlying feelings became stronger rather than weaker. Pretense peeled away, exposing. The band finished, these boots were made for walking, and Phoebe and the executive director separated and politely clapped. Phoebe scanned the crowd. Everyone was having a lot of fun. She could feel good about that. She saw Eddie on the fringes of the room, holding a Savannah sidecar. He wasn't dancing, and he wasn't talking to anyone, but he looked happy. Phoebe was rafting down a champagne river. The band launched into Love Potion Number 9. Phoebe grabbed the chief's hand. "Come on, Eddie, let's dance." "I don't dance," the chief said. "You know that. Not with my wife, not with the Queen of England." Phoebe pulled him onto the dance floor.
"But with me tonight, yes."
"No," he said, but he was trying not to smile.
"It's my party," Phoebe said, "and you'll dance if I want to."
And guess what? The chief could dance. He was as strong and solid and sure-footed as Phoebe's father. He led, she followed. She was 17 again, at the Whitefish Bay Pool Club at her homecoming dance. She had been runner-up.